I'll begin my talk this morning by reading one of Shinran Shonin's wasan, Shinran's hymns of the Nembutsu. This particular wasan is in praise of Prince Shotoku. Prince Shotoku is here just on the very far right side of the Onaijin area, off to the right here. So Prince Shotoku is very important to Shinran. He wrote probably 50 or perhaps 100 hymns in praise of Prince Shotoku. A few of these are collected in the hymns that we chant in our cycle of Wasan. So I'd like to share one of those with you this morning. Please join me in Gassho. Gassho onegaishimasu. Prince Shotoku, the world savior of great love, stays close to us like a father. Avalokiteshvara, the world savior of great compassion, stays close to us like a mother.
Daiji kuzei shotoku o chichi no hogotoku ni oashimasu. Daiji kuzei kanze hon haha no kotoku ni oashimasu.
Namandabutsu, namandabutsu, namandabutsu. Once again, thank you all for joining us this morning. Another of our Summa Dharma School sessions. Summer's just flying by, I think, for all of us, for me included. And finally, I'll be taking my little summer family vacation next week. This afternoon, I'll be flying back to Minnesota to spend a week with my parents. I'll be back here for in time for service next Sunday, but it'll be a nice trip home. And as I'm reflecting on this trip home and thinking of all the different times that I've, since leaving home, returned home. And this week, this time, I'm thinking all the way back to the very first time that I left home and then the very first time that I returned. When I was in high school, as I've perhaps mentioned in the past, I had the opportunity to spend 1 year in India as a youth exchange student. And I had gone away for some summer camps and so forth growing up as a kid, but this was my first time really going out and living apart from my parents. I lived there for over a year, and actually at the time, the guidelines for the Rotary Youth Exchange program that I was on are that if at all possible, one should stay in the country, not go back home, so don't like go home for Christmas or something like that, but you should really try to stay for the whole year, not go back. And very interestingly, they said the parents should, if at all possible, refrain from going to visit, because you know most of us were high school students. I was, I was 17 when I left, you know, kind of 16, 17, 18 in that range. And so the feeling was that it's a wonderful experience, but it's very difficult to kind of settle into life in a new country. And if you go home and then you come back, the idea was you're kind of hitting the reset button on your adjustment. You know, you get very homesick. You go through the whole process again. Or if your parents come to visit, also, you know, you could become very homesick after you leave. And they'd had this experience over the years with people. So they said, you know, we've found that the students who have the best time and overall kind of remain the most well-adjusted are those who, although it's difficult, you know, are able to spend just that 1 year immersed. And you can talk on the phone, you can send letters back and forth. Of course, in those days, it was 80 cents a minute to call Japan. Very expensive. Now it's, you know, I'm sure it's free. You could Skype for free now. But so I didn't see my parents for a whole year, an entire calendar year, actually. I was gone for almost an exact calendar year. I really made the most of that visa that they gave me. And as I was preparing to leave, my parents were understandably they were encouraging, but they had, you know, their natural concerns, natural worries. And, you know, so we went to the travel clinic at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, and I received probably 80 vaccinations for everything under the sun. You know, just shots and shots and more shots. You're going to India, and, you know, I was living in the middle of a large city, but, you know, you would think I was, like, going to be out in the jungle living in a hut or something. All these shots that I got, and these, you know, they gave me malaria medicine, and they says, you know, make sure you take this once a week the whole time you're there. I had all this medicine, so, you know, there was this, you know, so we had all of the medical things taken care of. I had orientations. They told me what to eat, you know, what not to eat. They say, you know, stay with your host family as much as possible. Do not eat out. Do not eat out. Eat what your host family serves. You know, the odds are your host family will be vegetarian. You will be a vegetarian while you are in India. If you go out, do not go out and eat meat at any old restaurant. If you're going to eat meat, only eat meat that is served by your host family or at a restaurant or hotel that your host family says is okay to eat meat. And this is how you will avoid any stomach problems. Of course, I still got stomach problems, but I would not eat any meat while I was out unless my host family felt that it was a good place. So we would, once in a while, we would go to a wedding that had a vegetarian buffet and a non-vegetarian buffet. And I remember my host father would say, you know, go eat that, go over, go eat some non-vegetarian food. He'd say, no, go eat some of that chicken. And he was a vegetarian, and he would sort of put, you know, encourage me, and he would come over, he'd say, is that good? Are you enjoying it? He wanted to make sure that I was getting my, you know, my meat and my my little dose of meat, because he knew this was probably the one time that month I would get to eat meat. So my host family took really good care of me. And my mother had one other concern, and that was as I was packing up my suitcases, you know, she would open up the door and she'd say, remember to pack your malaria medication. It's like, okay, I got it in my suitcase. And then she would come back an hour later. Did you get that malaria medication in there? Yes, I've got it. And one more thing. Yeah, I want you to come home as a Christian. No converting to Hinduism, right? She didn't say don't convert to Hinduism, but that was sort of the subtext. You know, you got to come home a Christian. And so I went over there, and I had no intentions of, you know, converting to any religions whatsoever. But I did. My host family, while they took good care of my diet, they also took good care of me emotionally. And so my host father was kind of like my counselor as I was going through all the difficulties and the struggles and the culture shock. He would give me good advice. He would listen to me. And he had such a down-to-earth, grounded perspective. He was a stockbroker. That was his job. And this was in the kind of the mid-90s. And so my image of stockbrokers was from movies like, you know, the Gordon Gekko, Wall Street, you know, just, you know, stockbrokers must all be really greedy, kind of, you know, materialistic people. And he was so, you know, so down to earth. He was quite well off, as all my host families were. But he and his wife lived in a very nice but simple apartment. Said, you know, we used to have a big house, but we don't need all that space. And I thought, wow, this, you know, such a wonderful, you know, spiritual perspective. He would say things like, my work is a prayer. Everything I do in my work is a prayer and an offering to the, you know, to all people and to all beings. And I would think, wow, what, you know, what a change, what a difference from my image of, you know, buy, sell, you know, just very calm. And I was telling my parents about him. Wow, you know, my host father is so spiritual and, you know, just giving me a whole new perspective on religion. And my mom immediately, you know, bells start going off. And she, you know, I remember one conversation. I was standing in this cramped little phone booth on the side of the road, you know, lots of street traffic, and I had to go out to a phone booth to use my calling card because you had to have special, only certain phones could do international dialing, and my host family's phone wasn't set up for international calls. So I had to go find a special phone booth, and I knew, you know, this one corner I could make a call. And so I went and I made the call, and it's, you know, it's about 85 degrees, 90 degrees, humid, lots of street noise, packed into this little phone booth, and over the scratchy line, my mom's saying, "Henry, now remember, you have to come home as a Christian," right? And so then I'm, you know, stressed out and worried and kind of burst out of this phone booth and stagger home. And when I got back to my host family's house, my father, my host father, looking at me, he could tell that, you know, something was bothering me as we're eating dinner. And he was a very direct person. He would say, "Henry, I can tell something's bothering you. What's on your mind? Tell me." And I said, "Well, you know, my mother's very, very worried about me. She's very concerned." And he said, "Oh no, has she heard about the recent outbreak of bubonic plague here in northern India? Is she worried that you're sick?" And he says, no, I'm, you know, she knows that you take very good care of me." "Oh, did she hear about that tourist in northern India who was kidnapped by the terrorists?" And I says, no, she's not worried about that." He says, "Well, what is her concern?" He says, "Well, she's worried that I'm going to become a Hindu." And he just burst out laughing. He says, "Ah, ha, ha, ha." And I kind of thought, well, you know, what's so funny? I'm kind of thinking about it. I'm considering it. And he said, "Henry, you can't become a Hindu." I said, "What? You already are a Hindu. Anyone who seeks the truth is a Hindu." Right? And so this was just a profound kind of shift in my perspective, my way of thinking about religion and spirituality. This is, you know, not about having some identity. Oh, I am this, I am that. But it's about, you know, seeking a true teaching. And, you know, as I spent time in India, I realized that Buddhism and the Buddhist teaching have really been kind of absorbed into Hinduism. That's why you don't see, in my mind, that's why you don't see Buddhism as a kind of large independent tradition in India, the way it is in China or Japan or Tibet, but it's part of this, you know, majority religious spirituality of India. And so as a, you know, as a young guy, high school student, I was, you know, I was a little bit of a brat to my parents, and I was a little bit, you know, I had a little bit of a Ijiwari kind of, you know, a little bit of a mean sense of humor, which I inherited from my father. And I knew that my mom was very concerned about me coming back a Hindu. And I had assured her on several occasions that I was not going to do that. But I also thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be fun if I got off the plane dressed in my finest Indian attire? My host family had generously gifted me with beautiful, you know, dhoti is like a big, it's like the thing that Gandhi would wear, like those big kind of, in those days, you know, they look kind of like MC Hammer pants, these big, baggy, flowing pants. So they'd given me very nice dhoti, so I was kind of proud of myself, I managed to tie that dhoti in the inside of the bathroom of an airplane on the flight from LAX to Minneapolis on my return flight. So I went in the bathroom, you know, wearing like my t-shirt and my jeans, and came out dressed like this, you know, Indian sage. I had the dhoti on, I had this long flowing white shirt, and my Hindu friends had said, "Okay, if you're gonna do this, you gotta do it right." You know, they gave me some of the, you know, the traditional thing to get a bindi, a little, you know, traditional marking on my forehead, and some ash to, you know, kind of put across, and they said, "Okay, this is how you do it." And I'd seen people do it, so I knew what it was supposed to look like. So I kind of went all in on this costume, and I came sort of, you know, ambling off the plane, and the first thing I did was sort of prostrate down at the feet of my host family in a kind of traditional Indian way. And, you know, I thought, you know, my parents were just kind of shocked, but they laughed. You know, they laughed. They thought it was funny. And I called my host father, and I was telling him, you know, "Oh, this is this prank that I played on my parents. Won't this be a good joke?" And he said, "Henry, I'm so proud of you. You have truly understood the heart of the Indian people. Reverence for your parents." Right? Because when I bowed down, he said, "Yes, this is what you must do. You must bow down in gratitude to your parents. And so this was sort of the beginning of my reverse culture shock, going back, readjusting to living in the Midwest, living in the climate. I went home. This was in early June. The summer months had begun. You know, it was in the high 70s. It was nice and warm. All my friends were in t-shirts and shorts. And I was there, having come from India, where it had been in the 90s. And I was wearing a sweatshirt and long jeans, and all my friends were looking at me like I was crazy, you know, and I was reacclimating. Also my way of speaking, because I didn't have any American friends while I was there. All my friends, all my classmates were Indian. And so I had picked up some of their sort of speech patterns in order to be understood. Like when I came and I spoke with my Midwestern American English, people couldn't understand what I was saying. So I had to change my accent to, you know, adapt to the local community. And I'd also picked up some of the Indian body language, you know, especially like South India where I was living. So, for example, when I wanted to say no to something, I would do that, just this little kind of cock of the head. And if I wanted to say okay, I did one of these. I mean, you probably, you know, here we have lots of Indians around, so you've probably seen people who do the kind of the head wobble. And it wasn't even conscious. I still remember my mother asking me one day, what would you like for lunch? Would you like to have a sandwich or would you like pasta? And I said, yeah, either one's fine. She said, okay, we'll do pasta. Is that okay? And I just did the head wobble. She's like, is that a yes or a no? I says, oh, yeah, that's okay. And so, you know, gradually I acclimated. But my mother, you know, my parents were sort of, I can't imagine, you know, they had this normal Minnesotan son who went off and who came back as this very different person. You know, I grew up a lot at the time. And I give them a lot of credit because, you know, they didn't push me away. They didn't treat me as this strange thing. They embraced me as I was. And so as I think about this kindness that I've experienced from my own parents and their willingness to accept and welcome me back, coming back as a kind of different person, that must have been very shocking for them. I'm reminded of the fact that Shinran Shonin often talks about the compassion of the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas as the compassion of a kind mother or a kind father. And he finds this particularly in the character of Prince Shotoku. In this wasan that I read at the start of my talk, Shinran says that the world savior Prince Shotoku, he's talking about Prince Shotoku, stays close to us like a father, right? Not pushing us away, but always staying close as a guide for us. Avalokiteshvara, the world savior of great compassion. Avalokiteshvara is a bodhisattva, the Bodhisattva of Compassion. Kannon or Guanyin is another name for this Avalokiteshvara. Always present, stays close to us like a mother. And for Shinran, Prince Shotoku was actually an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara in this world. So for Shinran, Prince Shotoku was the form that Kannon Bosatsu or Avalokiteshvara took to come into our world. And the reason Shinran felt that way is because the important role that Avalokiteshvara played in the introduction of Buddhism into Japan. When Buddhism first arrived in Japan from the Korean peninsula, not everybody was particularly excited about it. Some people saw this new, strange teaching coming in and thought, this is dangerous. Some of the things that are taught here in this Buddhist teaching are not in keeping with our cultural practices. Buddhism emphasizes the practice of leaving home, going out, separating from one's family to pursue the Buddha Dharma. Buddhist monks and nuns would traditionally leave society. Now, Japan, like much of East Asia, was sort of rooted in a Confucian value system. And so the idea that you would leave home and abandon your responsibilities to your family and to society and to the government was seen as very threatening, very threatening. And there were just kind of basic superstitious things like, you know, what is this weird teaching coming in. They have these statues. Nobody had ever seen like statues of a Buddha before. So they thought, ooh, this is some weird foreign god. What is it going to do? What kind of problems is it going to make? And it just so happened that with the arrival of one of the first Buddhist statues that came to Japan in Naniwa Bay, which is Osaka, as it arrived in that main port area, it coincided with a disease, an epidemic disease outbreak. Everybody was fine. Statue shows up. Everybody gets sick. A few people made a connection. They said, oh, it must be this statue has brought some bad luck from overseas. So we need to get rid of this statue. So you know what they did? They chucked it in Naniwa Bay. They threw it in the river, right? And so this was the attitude that people had. Now it's said that the statue later emerges from Naniwa Bay, completely unsoiled, immaculate, and pristine, and is then installed as the sacred image in the Zenkoji Temple. So it becomes, this story of this statue becomes a very significant story in the history of Japanese Buddhism, and Prince Shotoku is connected with this history because at this time when people were so afraid and so prejudiced against Buddhism that they were throwing beautiful artworks into the bay in order to try to protect themselves from it, Prince Shotoku was one who said, there's nothing to be afraid of here. Look at what this teaching says. This teaches wisdom and compassion. Prince Shotoku said, no one who understands and sincerely looks at this teaching, sincerely studies this teaching, can dispute it, can reject it, that this teaching can help everybody. And so Prince Shotoku was willing to stand up to people like particularly this certain minister called Moriya of Yuge, who was very powerful, very opposed to Buddhism. And Prince Shotoku stood up to him and said, no, this teaching can help all of us. So Prince Shotoku had that heart of a mother or a father, able to accept this teaching and realize this will care for all the people. This teaching will provide guidance for all of us. And so Shinran really felt this deep sense of closeness with Prince Shotoku, as if he was the parent who had given Shinran this wonderful gift of the Dharma. Because had it not been for Prince Shotoku, his open heart and his wisdom, then Buddhism would not have thrived in the way that it did in Japan, so that about 600 years later, when Shinran encounters this teaching, he realizes this is all thanks to Prince Shotoku. Okage-sama, right? Thanks to Prince Shotoku. So this is the heart of the Nembutsu that Shinran receives. It's often said that the seven masters are kind of the wisdom, the inspiration, the intellectual side of Shinran's Nembutsu appreciation. And Prince Shotoku is the compassion side, because Prince Shotoku played this really crucial role in introducing Buddhism and promoting the Nembutsu and promoting reverence for Amida Buddha. And so when we think of our own parents and the kindness and the patience that they've shown to us, we can also think of Prince Shotoku and the kindness that he showed to all beings without discrimination towards family member, non-family member, everybody. He was able to embrace them all. So I think we've all experienced this kind of kindness in our lives, and it's wonderful to reflect that Shinran shows us that we also experience this in the Nembutsu. I'd like to conclude my words here once again reading this hymn of Shinran Shonin. Please join me in Gassho. Gassho onegai shimasu. Prince Shotoku, the world savior of great love, stays close to us like a father. Avalokiteshvara, the world savior of great compassion, stays close to us like a mother. Daiji kuze shotoku o chichi no gotoku ni owashimasu. Daihi kuze kanze on haha no gotoku ni おわしますと。
ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ、ナマンダブツ。